So, imagine this. It's 1968, and an American oil tycoon just paid like $2.4 million for 10,000 tons of sinking granite.
Just a massive pile of wet rock.
Exactly. And he packs all this stone into these huge crates, ships it all the way through the Panama Canal, and then trucks it out into the middle of the blazing hot Arizona desert.
Which, I mean, at the time, everyone just thought he was buying this bizarre, overpriced tourist trap.
Right. But what he actually bought, and this is what we're getting into today, was the 2,000-year-old engine that accidentally birthed the entire city of London. So welcome to the deep dive.
Thanks. Yeah, it really is this profound shift in perspective when you realize that, cities don't just happen by accident. They're built around things like this.
They really are. And today, our source material is this incredibly comprehensive historical dossier all about London Bridge.
Which is such a misunderstood piece of infrastructure.
It totally is. And our mission with this deep dive for you listening right now is to basically shatter that illusion that London Bridge is just this one single static piece of architecture.
Right, because we tend to look at infrastructure as just, well, permanent. Like it's just some concrete slabs sitting over water.
Yeah, but the sources we're looking at today show that London Bridge is, honestly, it's more like this living, breathing entity. I mean, over the last two millennia, it has been burned to ashes, it's been rebuilt, stacked with what were basically medieval
Oh,
skyscrapers.
the houses,
Yeah,
yes.
and then eventually, literally shipped across an ocean.
It's an insane narrative. And it's entirely driven by these intense physical and economic forces.
Yeah.
But to really understand the sheer chaos of this bridge's life, we have to kind of look past the modern London skyline.
We have to go way back.
Right, back to the first century, to an era when the River Thames wasn't this neatly contained waterway you see today. It was this sprawling, really treacherous tidal marshland.
Okay, let's unpack this because we were talking about the Romans right around AD 50.
Exactly.
But they didn't just build a crossing because there was some bustling metropolis of Britons begging for like an easier morning commute.
No, there was no London at all.
Right. Our sources indicate the Romans built this timber bridge purely as a military shortcut. Like they were aggressively trying to consolidate their conquest of ancient Britain, and they just desperately needed a fast track across all those mudflats to get to their provincial capital.
Which was Camulodunum, or what we know today as Colchester.
Yeah. But the engineering challenge there must have been, well, it must have been a nightmare.
Oh, it was monumental.
Yeah.
Because you're dealing with a tidal estuary. The water level is fluctuating wildly every single day, and the riverbed is just soft clay and silt.
Just absolute muck.
Yeah, exactly. So Roman engineers had to use this early form of pile driving. They used these massive heavyweights to just pound thick oak timbers deep, deep down into the riverbed clay until they finally hit something solid enough to support a wooden deck.
Wow. And they just picked that spot randomly?
Well, no. They picked that specific spot because the southern embankment had this slight natural causeway above the swamp, and the northern side sloped up to higher ground. It was pretty much the only mathematically viable spot to force a crossing.
So it's essentially the ancient equivalent of like a modern interstate highway off-ramp being built in the absolute middle of nowhere just because the topography allowed it.
That is a great way to put it. It was a purely logistical calculation by military engineers.
But because this highly stable, highly guarded crossing suddenly existed over these awful marshlands, opportunistic traders were like, hey, captive audience.
Right, the Roman legions have money to spend.
Exactly. So this little settlement takes root on the dry northern bank just to sell goods to the troops passing through. And they called it Londinium.
I just love the deduction in the dossier here. The city didn't get a bridge. The bridge literally grew a city.
What's fascinating here is the sheer strategic advantage that physical crossing created. I mean, before that pile-driven timber bridge, if you wanted to cross the Thames, you had to use ferries or these really perilous fords.
Which would just heavily bottleneck any kind of movement completely. But suddenly, you have this uninterrupted mass movement of foot traffic, horses, wheeled carts. The bridge ended up linking four major arterial road systems from the north to four in the south.
Wow.
It permanently altered the power dynamics of ancient Britain. It became so vital that even after the local Iceni tribe burned the whole thing down, the bridge and the town during the Boudiccan Revolt in AD 60, the Romans just immediately poured resources into rebuilding both.
They just couldn't afford to lose it.
Right.
But eventually, the Romans do pull out of Britain, right, around the 5th century, and the infrastructure just crumbles. Londinium is largely abandoned, and the Thames kind of reverts back to this tense, dangerous boundary line between rival Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
Yeah, you've got Mercia on one side, Wessex on the other.
So the bridge goes from being this vital trade route to just being a massive military target.
It becomes a huge tactical liability, depending entirely on who holds it. Mm. And if we jump forward a bit to the Viking invasions, the bridge is literally right in the crosshairs.
Oh, this part of the dossier is wild.
It is. The dossier highlights this incredible Norse poetic history, this skaldic tradition that details a specific battle in 1014. The Danish forces had occupied both the walled city of London on the north and the settlement of Southwark on the south.
So they control both ends.
Exactly. So to break their grip, the Saxon king Ethelred the Unready, along with his ally Olaf, they actually sailed up the Thames and intentionally tore the bridge down.
Wait, pulling down their own bridge? I mean, sure, it cuts off the Danish army, but it also destroys their own most valuable infrastructural asset. It's like, I don't know, it's like burning down your own house just to trap a burglar.
It was a wildly desperate calculation. The sources say they tied ropes from their longships directly to the bridge's timber pilings, and then they just rowed furiously downstream until the structure snapped and collapsed.
Just plunging all those fully armored Danish soldiers straight into the rushing Thames.
Right. And historically speaking, that specific tactical demolition is heavily theorized by historians to be the true origin of the nursery rhyme, London Bridge is Falling Down.
Which is so dark. Like, kids today are just happily singing this peppy little melody, and it's actually about this brutal Viking-era drowning tactic.
Yeah, the history is a lot grimmer than the song. But, you know, the underlying issue here is the material itself. Timber bridges just keep braining down or collapsing or getting torn apart by longships.
Yeah, having to rebuild a massive oak structure across a tidal river every few decades sounds like an economic nightmare.
Oh, it was a constant crippling financial drain. And that is the specific mechanism that finally forced the crown to shift to stone. The demand for something permanent just became impossible to ignore.
So this is when King Henry II steps in.
Yes. In 1176, he commissions this monumental stone crossing. And the politics behind it were incredibly tense, actually.
Right, because didn't he order it partially as, like, a public act of penance?
He did. His knights had just murdered Thomas Becket, the Archbishop of Canterbury. And Becket was a Londoner. He was fiercely beloved by the public.
So Henry is trying to do damage control.
Exactly. To appease the populace, the new stone bridge was designed to feature this massive grand chapel right at the center of it, totally dedicated to Becket as a martyr.
Wow. And the construction itself was this huge multi-generational ordeal, right? Overseen first by Peter of Colechurch and then finally finished in 1209 by a French monk named Isembert.
Yeah, it took decades.
And this structure was a behemoth. The sources say it was 926 feet long, resting on 19 stone arches. But, okay, I have to push back on the engineering logic of what happens next.
The houses.
The houses. The dossier notes they eventually build up to 140 massive, top-heavy wooden houses directly on top of this narrow stone roadway.
Right.
We're talking structures up to 6 stories high. How on earth do you build an entire wooden neighborhood on a 15-foot-wide stone path without the whole thing just immediately capsizing into the river?
It is mind-boggling, but it required some incredibly aggressive architectural workarounds. Because that stone roadway was so narrow, the builders utilized a mechanism called hammer beams.
Okay, what are those?
Basically, there were these massive, heavy wooden cantilevers laid horizontally across the stone piers. And they extended violently out into the open air, just hanging right above the rushing water.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And then the houses were built outward onto these beams. So you had structures up to 34 feet deep, with the vast majority of their actual floor space suspended precariously over the edge of the bridge.
So the back halves of these multi-story houses are literally just dangling in midair over a tidal river?
Yes.
But why take that kind of insane risk?
The answer is entirely financial. I mean, maintaining a stone bridge of that magnitude in a highly corrosive tidal environment is astronomically expensive. The stone is constantly needing repair. The mortar gets washed away.
And I'm guessing the city didn't just want to raise taxes to pay for it.
Exactly. They didn't want to rely solely on taxes. So building these houses and leasing them out to wealthy merchants became the primary way to generate rent. That rent paid for the bridge's constant upkeep.
So it was essentially the medieval equivalent of an airport terminal. Like, the city didn't want to foot the bill for the runway, so they just trapped a captive audience of travelers inside this narrow corridor of duty-free luxury shops to subsidize the concrete.
That is a remarkably accurate parallel. It was completely self-funding infrastructure model. But that financial model created a devastating hydrodynamic consequence for the river itself.
How so?
Well, to protect those stone piers from the relentless pounding of the tide, the engineers constructed these enclosures around them called starlings.
Right, I saw diagrams of these in the dossier.
Yeah, they were these massive boat-shaped defensive pilings driven right into the riverbed and filled with heavy rubble.
But there were 19 of these arches, so there were 19 of these massive starlings. If you look at the physical diagrams, these things took up roughly 5/6 of the river's total width.
Which effectively turned the bridge into a giant weir, or basically a dam. You take the immense natural tidal flow of the River Thames and just severely choking it.
So the water has nowhere to go.
Right. When the tide changed, millions of gallons of water were suddenly forced to violently squeeze through these very narrow gaps between the starlings. It created a huge bottleneck. The water level on one side of the bridge could literally be 6 feet higher than on the other side.
A 6-foot vertical drop just in the middle of a river.
Yes. It generated these ferocious churning rapids. And watermen in these small boats would actually regularly attempt a maneuver called shooting the bridge.
Which sounds terrifying.
It was. They'd try to steer their vessels down the rushing rapids when the tide was flowing. And the physics of the water made it incredibly lethal. Hundreds of people drowned attempting it over the years.
I can't even imagine.
The hydrodynamics were so widely feared that it actually birthed a popular proverb at the time. London Bridge was for wise men to pass over and for fools to pass under.
Wise men over, fools under.
I love that.
But honestly, even passing over it required nerves of steel because the bridge was fundamentally this densely packed floating commercial district. It naturally bred absolute chaos.
Oh, the congestion was legendary.
And here's where it gets really interesting for me. Try to visualize the daily reality of old London Bridge. You are walking down this dark tunnel-like street because the upper floors of the houses on either side literally connected over your head to stabilize each other.
Right, blocking out the sun.
Yeah. And on the ground floor, you have these high-end merchants. You could buy luxury haberdashery, imported gloves, rare books. But the moment you stepped toward the edge of the bridge, you were dodging falling latrines and boiled severed heads.
Yeah, the psychological dissonance of the bridge was just staggering. Because in addition to all those commercial houses and the chapel, the bridge also featured a drawbridge tower and a fortified stone gate at its southern approach.
And that gate wasn't just for defense, right?
No. That stone gate served a highly calculated macabre function. It operated as a sort of political billboard where the crown displayed the severed heads of executed traitors.
It was basically a brutal form of urban decor, and they didn't just place the heads on spikes. The dossier explains the process was highly industrialized.
Yes, the executioners would actually dip the severed heads in vats of boiling tar first.
Ugh, the smell must have been awful.
Terrible. But they did it to preserve them against the damp London weather and to keep the river seagulls from, you know, scavenging them.
That is so dark.
It really established a gruesome precedent. The very first recorded head placed on the gate was William Wallace in 1305.
Oh, wow. Braveheart.
Exactly. And over the centuries, it became the final resting place for historically towering figures, including Thomas More and Thomas Cromwell. But what really stands out in the sources is the sheer normalization of this violence.
Yeah, people just got used to it.
Completely. By 1598, there's a German tourist named Paul Hintzner visiting London, and he has casually noted in his travel diary that he counted over 30 tarboiled heads displayed on the gate at a single time.
Just a casual tourist observation. Oh, look, 30 heads.
Just another day in medieval London.
But the political hazards of the bridge were almost secondary to the sheer structural peril of living on a hammer beam over a tidal river. I mean, the dossier details this one incident in 1481 where a massive, multi-seated public latrine that hung out over the side of the bridge simply gave way.
Yeah, the structural integrity was always fighting a losing battle against gravity and moisture.
It collapsed entirely into the Thames, and 5 men drowned in pretty much the most horrific way imaginable.
It's awful. Yet, ironically, that precarious wooden neighborhood inadvertently saved the broader city from total annihilation later on.
Oh, right, the firebreak.
Exactly. In 1633, a severe localized fire broke out and completely destroyed the wooden houses on the northern third of the bridge. And the city was really slow to rebuild, which left this massive empty gap of bare stone.
And then 33 years later?
Right. In 1666, the Great Fire of London sweeps through the capital, literally incinerating everything in its path. But when the flames reached the bridge, they hit that empty stone gap from the old fire.
It acted as a flawless natural fire break.
Yes. It stopped the inferno from crossing the river and completely wiping out the borough of Southwark on the south side.
So the bridge sacrifices a third of itself to save the southern half of the city. That's amazing.
Hmm.
But even without the constant threat of fire, the daily logistics of the bridge were basically collapsing under the weight of an expanding empire, right?
Oh, absolutely. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the sheer density and localized chaos of London Bridge forced these early forms of urban regulation that literally shaped modern society.
Because it was just too crowded.
Way too crowded.
Hmm.
By the early 18th century, the congestion on this 15-foot-wide road was paralyzing. You had a daily collision of heavy horse-drawn carts, massive flocks of sheep being driven to market, and just thousands of pedestrians.
It's just a total gridlock.
The economic arteries of London were clogging. So to solve this, the Lord Mayor finally intervened in 1722 with a strict decree. All traffic entering the city from the south must keep to the west side of the bridge, and all traffic leaving must keep to the east.
A strict keep left policy. And this is vital for you as a listener today. If you have ever rented a car in the UK and felt completely disoriented trying to drive on the left side of the road, you are literally dealing with the behavioral fallout of a traffic jam caused by medieval haberdashers and sheep herders over 300 years ago.
It's incredible, right? It perfectly illustrates how hyper-localized infrastructure bottlenecks can permanently rewrite national behaviors.
But those legal workarounds couldn't fix the underlying physics of the bridge itself. By the 1750s, the houses were heavily subsiding.
Right. The city even attempted to improve the river navigation by removing the central tier to create this single great arch. But altering the hydrodynamics only weakened the remaining structure further.
So the medieval bridge was just fundamentally doomed by its own immense weight and the fierce river scouring that it caused.
Yeah. Which means that self-funding airport terminal model completely fails in the end.
So in 1761, the city finally orders all those medieval houses demolished. No more falling latrines, no more tunnel-like streets.
And they held a massive competition to design a replacement.
Yeah, and Thomas Telford pitches this visionary single-span iron arch, but it's rejected. Why was that?
Because building the approaches for an arch that size would require bulldozing far too much incredibly valuable riverbank real estate. The city just wouldn't do it.
So they opt for a safer, more conservative five-arch stone design engineered by John Rennie.
Right. Rennie's new London Bridge opened in 1831, constructed just 100 feet upstream from the medieval site.
And it was vastly wider.
Yes. And it was built using Hayter granite, which is an exceptionally dense, heavy igneous rock. And honestly, for a few decades, it functioned brilliantly. By 1896, the dossier notes it was the busiest single point in all of London, processing 8,000 pedestrians every single hour.
That's a massive volume of people. But a quiet, catastrophic failure was occurring beneath the waterline, wasn't it?
It was.
The bridge was sinking. And it wasn't a subtle shift either. The surveys revealed it was sinking into the riverbed at a rate of an inch every 8 years. By the 1920s, one side of the bridge was visibly, measurably lower than the other.
You could literally see the tilt.
But why? I mean, we just talked about how Roman pile driving and medieval stone piers stood for centuries. Why does a 19th century marvel of engineering suddenly start sinking into the mud?
It comes down to a fatal combination of soil mechanics and altered hydrodynamics. Remember the starlings from the old medieval bridge?
The ones that acted like a dam?
Exactly.
Yeah.
When the city finally demolished the old bridge, they removed that massive dam effect. Suddenly, the Thames was flowing freely and much, much faster than it had in 600 years.
Oh, wow. So the water is just tearing through there now.
Right. That newly accelerated water heavily scoured the riverbed, basically washing away the protective layers of silt and gravel around the foundations of Rennie's new bridge.
So it undermined the whole structure.
Completely. You combine that aggressive scouring with the softer London clay underneath and then add the astronomical crushing weight of that Hayter granite, and the bridge literally began to press itself down into the earth.
The removal of the old bridge's flaws actually doomed the new bridge. It's a tragic engineering irony. So by the 1960s, the city of London realizes they're facing another crisis. The granite bridge is failing.
It's actively sinking.
And this is where a city official named Ivan Luckin steps up with a proposal that defies all logic. He looks at the sinking, failing 130-year-old stone structure and says, "Let's sell it."
I mean, it sounds completely absurd on its face.
Yeah.
But Luckin understood global marketing. And in 1968, he found an eager buyer in an American entrepreneur and chainsaw magnate named Robert P. McCulloch.
And McCulloch paid $2.46 million for the structure.
He did.
Okay, I want to pause right here and address a wildly persistent urban legend about this. Because the rumor always claims that this wealthy, foolish American thought he was buying Tower Bridge, you know, the iconic Gothic one with the two massive towers that everyone takes selfies in front of, and that he was utterly devastated when a plain, flat, stone bridge arrived in boxes.
Right. Everyone has heard that story. But our dossier unequivocally debunks that myth.
Completely.
Ivan Luckin himself went on the historical record to deny it. Robert McCulloch knew exactly what he was purchasing. He wasn't a confused tourist. He was a highly calculating real estate developer.
So what does this all mean? If a 19th century stone bridge is actively sinking into the Thames mud under its own crushing weight, why on earth would a calculating American oil and chainsaw tycoon think it is a sound investment to buy it, ship it across the Atlantic, and reassemble it in the middle of a barren, blistering Arizona desert?
This raises an important question about the intangible value of historical provenance. McCulloch wasn't really buying infrastructure. He was buying legitimacy. He was attempting to develop a brand new master-planned community called Lake Havasu City on this incredibly remote peninsula in Arizona. And he desperately needed a hook. He needed a massive tourist attraction to draw prospective buyers out into the desert just to sell them empty lots.
So it was a marketing stunt.
Exactly. Well, he didn't just buy 10,000 tons of heavy granite. He purchased a globally recognized 2,000-year-old legacy. He bought the brand name London Bridge to artificially inject history into a city that literally had none.
It is the ultimate real estate flex. They numbered every single granite block, shipped them over to a port in California, and then trucked them across the desert. And here's the true engineering sleight of hand. They didn't even rebuild a solid stone bridge in Arizona.
No, they couldn't.
Right, solid stone would just sink into the Arizona sand the same way it sank into the Thames clay. Instead, engineers built this highly functional, hollow, steel-reinforced concrete bridge that could easily handle modern automobile traffic.
Which is very smart.
And then they took McCulloch's historic London Bridge granite blocks and essentially glued them to the outside of the concrete core like a decorative veneer, like tiling a bathroom.
Yeah, it's just a facade.
They even had to dredge a completely artificial mile-long channel underneath it just to give the bridge some water to actually cross.
It's wild, but the audacity of the project is matched only by its success. When the bridge was fully rededicated in Arizona in 1971, McCulloch actually flew the real Lord Mayor of London out for the ceremony.
That's hilarious.
And the gimmick worked flawlessly. It drew massive crowds, it drove land sales through the roof, and it permanently put Lake Havasu City on the map.
And meanwhile, back in London, the city authorities quietly took McCulloch's $2.4 million and used it to help fund the construction of the modern London Bridge, which officially opened in 1973.
Which brings us to the bridge that spans the Thames today.
Yeah. If you look at it now, it's a pre-stressed concrete box girder bridge, which I know sounds like heavy engineering jargon, but the genius of it is the hollow box design.
Right.
Inside the concrete are these high-tension steel cables that are pulled incredibly tight. That's the pre-stressed part, which gives the structure immense strength. But because the inside is basically a hollow rectangular box, the bridge is incredibly light compared to solid granite.
So it finally solves the 2,000-year-old problem.
Yes. Yeah. A bridge that won't sink into the soft London clay.
It is a triumph of utilitarian engineering. It perfectly serves its purpose without the catastrophic side effects of all its predecessors.
And
interestingly, it's funded entirely by the Ancient Bridge House Estates.
Wait, what is that?
It's a charitable trust that was actually established way back in the medieval era to maintain the original stone bridge. And it still exists, safely transporting tens of thousands of commuters every single day.
It's highly practical now. No toll houses, no six-story mansions dangling over the water, definitely no severed heads.
Thankfully.
Yet, despite its quiet modern efficiency, global pop culture still fundamentally misunderstands it. I mean, think about 2006, when the pop star Fergie released a massive Billboard number one hit literally titled London Bridge.
Oh, I know where this is going.
When you watch that multi-million dollar music video, what landmark is prominently featured in the background?
It's Tower Bridge.
Exactly, Tower Bridge. We simply cannot help ourselves. We constantly crave that romantic, gothic aesthetic, even when the real history is vastly more fascinating.
It really is. The true history proves that the built environment is just anything but static.
Mm.
You know, we walk over infrastructure every day, assuming that concrete and steel are permanent fixtures of the landscape.
That they've always been there and always will be.
Right. But the 2,000-year dossier of London Bridge proves that a city's infrastructure is just as fluid, just as adaptable, and often just as chaotic as the humans who design it.
It constantly morphs to survive the economic pressures, the traffic jams, and the bizarre real estate schemes of whatever era it finds itself in. Which actually leaves us with a final, slightly philosophical paradox for you to mull over long after this deep dive ends.
I love a good paradox.
There's an ancient thought experiment called the Ship of Theseus. It asks, if you systematically replace every single wooden plank on a ship over the years, is it still fundamentally the same ship?
Right.
Now, apply that specific logic to our bridge. If a 19th century granite bridge is completely dismantled block by block, shipped thousands of miles across an ocean, and its outer stones are just glued around a hollow, steel-reinforced concrete core over an artificial canal in the American desert, is that structure still actually London Bridge?
Or did London Bridge permanently cease to exist the very second it was packed into crates and taken away from the damp banks of the River Thames?
Exactly. So think about the permanence of the ground beneath your feet the next time you cross a river.